Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to Torah Studies. This is our weekly foray? Does that work? Into the Torah portion. I'm your host, Rabbi Ari Solish, and it's wonderful to have you all here. So the Torah portion this week is Emor, and I want to kind of shape the discussion right at the get-go. You know, there's a lot of there are a lot of things that we do that are in our comfort zone, and some things that sometimes we need to do that's outside of our comfort zone. It's been said that the greatest growth happens when we do things that are out of our comfort zone. So as long as we kind of exist, as long as we do kind of in our box and what we're comfortable with, so there's a certain amount of growth, maybe a steady growth. We keep on doing good things, so there's... But a person truly grows when they're faced with a challenge that they're basically not ready to face, and they have to step up to the challenge. That really can affect a person in a marvelous way. So with keeping that in mind, let's jump into a major theme of the opening of our Torah portion. So the Torah portion, let's jump into the Chumash right away. Torah portion is Emor. And you can find it in the Chumash, in the Gunak edition, on page 780 and 781. So, as we're in the book of Leviticus, so the theme of the book of Leviticus, the book of Vayikra, the theme is the temple or the Mishkan, the priests, and the service in the tabernacle by the priests. So, at the very get-go, we have a command that God is saying to Moshe, to Moses, to tell his brother, Aaron, and his sons, the other priests. So let's begin. Let's jump right into the beginning, to the opening verses, and to the opening mitzvah of our Torah portion. Ray, if you don't mind, here, read from the Chumash, please. I'll get it open. Oh, you have it. I'm sorry. 780, 781.
God said to Moshe, "Speak to the priests, Aaron's sons, and say to them, let no priest become ritually impure through contact with a dead person, when there are others among his people who contend to the burial. Except for his wife, who is his closest relative, his mother, his father, his son, his daughter, his brother, his virgin sister, if she is still close to him, because she was never with a man. He must make himself ritually impure to bury her and all his other close relatives."
So let's stop here for a minute and let's analyze what this mitzvah, what the Torah is telling us. So there's a few important details here. Okay, so number one, this is a mitzvah said specifically to the Kohanim, to the priests, to Aaron, who was the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, and his sons, who were conventional priests. Okay, so this is a mitzvah that is only to the priestly families. And the mitzvah is not to become ritually impure. Now, why is that a problem? Why is it a problem for a priest to become... It doesn't say it here, but I'm asking you. Why is it a problem for the priest to become ritually impure? What does that limit the priest in doing? What? Let me ask you. Well, hold on. Well, yes, that's how it plays out today. But if the priest was impure, what could he not do? What could an impure priest... Yeah, you can't go into the Holy of Holies. You can't even go into the temple. A priest cannot go into the temple or serve in the temple in a state of ritual impurity. So, the priests are commanded not to enter into the... Alex, there should be copies right over there, and right now we're in the Chumash, page 780, 781, Torah portion of Emor. So, a priest was not permitted to serve in the temple in a state of impurity. There are many different ways in which one can get into a state of impurity. The most severe way of entering into state of impurity is by being in touch, by being in contact with a human, with a deceased human being. So coming in contact with a dead body renders one the highest degree of impurity. And if a Kohen is in a state of impurity, then they cannot serve in the temple. Now, so here's the catch. Since a priest, a Kohen, like a doctor, is always on call, right? They used to have beepers. I'm joking. No beepers. But right, a priest is always on call. You never know when the next big sacrificial service is coming up. It's like, hey, we need a few good priests. So therefore, Kohanim in general stayed away, and we've discussed this before, stayed away from any level, any measure of impurity. Which is why today, for example, Kohanim, even though there's no temple, there's no sacrificial service. So you would think, like, okay, you know, it's a non-issue. Even today, a Kohen does not go to a cemetery, and there are other restrictions on his state of ritual purity. Okay, getting back to our immediate discussion in the Torah portion. The Torah says that in general, so the opening verse, let no priest become ritually impure through contact with a dead person. And then the next verse, verse number 2, says, except for close relatives. So here the Torah provides an exception. Although a priest, although a Kohen, in general, should not become in a state of impurity, should not come to a state of impurity by being in touch, by becoming in contact with someone who is deceased, the exceptions are when it's a close relative. Yes? Make sense? Why is that an exception? Why are close relatives an exception? It's in his house. Good. I think more from I don't know the official answer, but I was thinking, perhaps, and maybe I should look it up in the commentaries before I tell you what I think, but I'll just tell you what I think. I think that maybe part of the mourning and grieving process is to allow the Kohen to be present at the funeral and to be participate in the funeral, the burial of a close relative. Again, if it's a sister who's already married and she has a husband or whatever, then she has another family that can take care of it. But otherwise, a person's close relatives, we should allow, the Torah says, God says, I allow them, although they should otherwise be in a state of purity and not come in contact with the deceased individual, but if it's a close relative, you have to allow that closure, you have to allow that grieving process to happen, and part of that is to be present with the deceased. Yeah.
Isn't that a problem in Israel today about a son going to his father's in some cemeteries there?
So what they because the Torah allows for the Kohen and for other individuals, certainly other individuals. No, for a Kohen, because we're talking about Kohanim, for a Kohen to come in contact with a relative. But what it doesn't say is that the Kohen can come in contact with other people that are also deceased. So walking through a cemetery, the problem there is that they're not only coming in contact with a deceased relative, God forbid, but also with, you know, hundreds or dozens of other deceased, which the Torah does not permit. Therefore, there are ways. Many cemeteries have a special place near the road, or you can have, I know in New York, sometimes they have a special box that you can, it's like you step into a box, and the box is halachically high enough, and wide enough, to create its own domain inside the box. So the Kohen is not in the cemetery, it's in the box. We're speaking today by getting out of the box, but now I'm speaking about a different type of box. So there are ways kind of around it. You can create a path, again, with a certain height, and that kind of creates an isolation space where a Kohen could go in. So there are different ways that this can be done. But the overall point is that a Kohen is commanded by God in the Torah to stay away from ritual impurity, including that of a deceased human being, or maybe especially a deceased human being, because that's like the highest level of impurity. There's an exception given with a close relative. There's another exception to the rule. This is very interesting. So if you look back at the text in the Chumash on page 781, and the parentheses do a little bit of foreshadowing on this, and it's based on Rashi, but if you look at the first bullet point on 21, it says, let no priest become ritually impure through contact with a dead person when there are others among his people who can tend to the burial. In the original Hebrew, it doesn't have the parentheses, and it says, lenefesh lo yitama ba'amav. It adds an extra word, ba'amav. It says, the priest should not come in contact with a soul, in other words, with a deceased human being, ba'amav, amongst his people. What does it mean, amongst his people? So Rashi explains, when the deceased is amongst his people, i.e., that the person passes away. Not the relative. The relative is an exception anyway. But a general, right, somebody else passes away in a community. So others can tend to the burial. So then the priest does not have to get involved. But when there's no one around, then it becomes a different status called a met mitzvah, which means, how do you translate met mitzvah? It's a mitzvah deceased. It's not a dead mitzvah. I mean, it's a deceased individual that constitutes now a mitzvah to bury them, and therefore a Kohen could also do that as well, which we'll see in text 1b. Okay, so David, please read text 1b. 69. Oh, I should wish you Mazal Tov on the new birth. Mazal Tov. Text 1b, yeah. So now we're in the Torah Studies text, page 69, and this is Rashi's commentary on the opening verse of our Torah portion.
Let none of you defile himself for a dead person among his people. So this prohibition applies while the dead person is among his people. Meaning he has people, non-Kohanim, to bury. This comes to exclude from the prohibition a met mitzvah, a dead person for whom no one is in calling distance to attend to his burial, and thus it is incumbent for people to attend to him.
So here we have an incredible exception, and it's derived from seemingly an extra word in the Torah, as I mentioned before, ba'amav. And here now, the commentaries and the Talmud and all of the great halakha codifiers say that the Torah is adding one more exception to the rule that a Kohen cannot become ritually impure by coming in contact with a dead body. So in general, a Kohen should not get involved with any burials. No burials for the Kohen. Except if it's a family member and a close relative, and except if the deceased, help me out, if the deceased has no one else. So again, typically a Kohen, don't get involved, don't join the Chevra Kadisha, which is the burial society, don't prepare bodies for burial, don't get involved if you're a Kohen. Except if it's for a close relative, and as derived from the language in our verse, if there's no one else to do it. If the deceased passes away in the middle of a town, with a cemetery, with a burial society, with people that can take care of it. So we tell the Kohen, don't get involved. You got to stay pure. You have to be ready to serve in the temple. But if you find a body, if you come across a body, a met mitzvah, which means that the person has passed away and there's no one else to do it, so gesund. And the Kohen is the one who finds the body. So what do you do? Sorry, got to keep on going. There's no one around. How can you leave a body? How can you leave a deceased individual? So it goes on, without taking care of them. So the Torah says, based on this inference, the Torah is teaching us that yes, a Kohen must get involved and must become ritually impure to take care of this, to take care of this deceased. That is what is a met mitzvah. That is what it means. That is what a mitzvah burial, someone who passed away, that it becomes a mitzvah to bury them, that's what it means. Now, the truth is, the concept of burying a dead body is always a mitzvah, whether it's in a community with many people or whether it's, God forbid, someone's found in the middle of nowhere and only one person comes across them. It's always a mitzvah. In other words, every deceased individual is a mitzvah. But we don't refer to it as a met mitzvah unless it's a situation where no one else can bury except for the individual that's come across it. Does it make sense? Sort of, yes. In other words, okay, let's do text 2a. Amy, please read text 2a, page 70, Rambam. By the way, here we have in Maimonides, in his Sefer HaMitzvot, which is the book of the 613 Mitzvot, he clarifies the origin of the mitzvah of burying a person after they passed away. You'll be fascinated, I think you'll be fascinated by the origins.
This all applies to all deceased. Every Jew should be buried on the day in which he passed away.
What do you see from Maimonides? What's the origin? How do we know that there's a mitzvah to bury somebody soon after they pass away? What's the origin? It's a strange origin.
Execution.
Capital punishment. The Torah says, when the court has to execute someone, so you take care of the punishment, but then you cannot leave the body. You know in some, I hate even mentioning this, but you know in some cultures when they kill somebody, they do it public, and they hang the body, and they keep it around, like to kind of prove a point, that whole thing, the Torah says completely goes the other way. Even in case of capital punishment, you have to immediately, you don't make a showcase of it, it's not a spectacle, it's not a thing, you have to respect the body, and you immediately have to bury the body on the same day. So, fascinatingly enough, Maimonides says the source text of the mitzvah to bury someone who passes away comes from this I'm going to call it an odd case, but maybe a troubling case of a court mandated execution where the Torah says to bury. That's how we know to bury. There are other biblical inferences. You know, the verse states, "From dust you come, and dust you shall return." You know, it says that in Genesis. Like, there are other verses that talk about the idea of burial. But the actual commandment in the Torah, after post-Sinai, to bury the deceased, is written in the context of capital punishment. But yet we derive, if even in a case of capital punishment, you have to bury the body right away, how much more so in a natural case of death, right, or in other cases of death, that weren't in the category of punishment, certainly you have to respect the body and bury the body, bury the individual immediately. So there's always a mitzvah to bury. So technically, and this is what I mentioned before, technically every deceased individual is a mitzvah. Met mitzvah, every deceased, it's a mitzvah to bury. But that's not what we mean. What we mean is, as he continues text 2b, Amy, one more text, again, straight up from Maimonides. Sifri is one of the halachic codifiers.
It's a man, it's a human being.
Yeah, the Sifri was, I forgot who authored it, but the Sifri is the name of the Sefer, is the name of the book, yeah. Yeah.
This is the reason why a person who has nobody to arrange his burial is called a met mitzvah. This means that he is a met person for whom the mitzvah is on every individual to bury. The mitzvah referred to him is the verse that states he must certainly bury him on the same day.
So Rambam Maimonides explains that why is it called a met mitzvah? Because usually when a person passes away amongst a community, in a city of people, so here's the question. Who has the mitzvah to bury this person? Who has the mitzvah? Somebody passes away in a large community. So who has the mitzvah?
The relative, no.
A relative, but you could say in general, the community, everyone has, in a sense. Right? Everyone has. But if this person passes away alone, right? There's nobody to arrange the burial. Person's in the middle of nowhere, and if someone else comes across this deceased individual, so now it's a mitzvah on them. It's always a mitzvah, but is it a mitzvah on you? It's only a mitzvah. So the moment you, not you, but the moment one encounters, a person encounters a deceased individual in a context that no one else is around, the moment that happens, this general mitzvah to bury an individual, you know, as soon as possible, becomes focused on the one who finds the body. That's why it's not just a general met mitzvah, it's a met mitzvah, it's a mitzvah to bury this person that now falls on the finder. If the finder's a Kohen, we learned before, still his mitzvah. Cannot say, I'm a Kohen, who's going to bury this person? Met mitzvah means you have to do it. As we're about to see, and we have several halachic texts, it's a fascinating law, how in many cases, other big mitzvot are pushed off to take care of this immediate mitzvah. And people that we might think should not get involved with this because maybe they have better things to do, or maybe they're in some way cautioned not to get involved in these types of activities. If there's no one else around, you have to step up to the plate. Yeah.
So I was with my husband when he passed away. And it was a Friday morning, and the rabbi said, "You must bury him." I said, "I can't do that.
Right.
My son's coming from Israel."
Right.
So we buried him on Sunday.
Right. So here's the thing. It's a very good question you're asking, or a very good point that you're making. The mitzvah is ideally to bury on the same day. But considering the fact that it's going to be, in some cases, very painful for the relatives and perhaps even the deceased to not have family that needs to come in, arrive, etc. So there are some allowances made in these types of situations to allow people to come in. Now, you have to understand, back in the day, either you lived there or it would take 2 months to get there, right? I mean, like, think about it. It's like either you lived in the area and you'll be there for the funeral, or you got to get a boat and somehow, you know, make it back. So it's not a thing where you can push off a day or two. But now, with airplanes and whatever, so rabbis, halacha allows a dispensation, again, in certain circumstances to push it off. But ideally, it's done as soon as possible. Okay, let's take a look at text 3. Text 3 is from Karen. Please read text 3 from the Shulchan Aruch Code of Jewish Law. This is how it is formulated there regarding met mitzvah.
What is a met mitzvah? A body that was found on the road or in a non-Jewish city, and there is nobody to bury it.
By the way, the implication is, even if it's a busy city, if it's not a Jewish city, in other words, there's not a Jewish funeral home and all that stuff, so they're not going to get a Jewish burial. Right, that's the challenge. Right. They wouldn't get a Jewish burial. So, okay, continue.
If there's no Jewish person in the location the body was found who can be called to take care of the burial, whoever finds it is forbidden to move from that spot without burying.
Look at that expression. You cannot move. You cannot even run to the next town to call somebody. Continue. It's like, this is how it is in Shulchan Aruch Code of Jewish Law, straight up.
Yeah, but
what if you can't?
Like, what if you're in a city?
Okay. No. Today it's different. You have a cell phone, you can make a call. Right? But it's saying, can you abandon the body? Again, think about, like, you know, 300 years ago. Are you allowed to abandon the body and make it to the next village and come back maybe in a half a day, maybe longer, and risk that this body will become defiled by animals? I mean, this is what's discussed in Jewish law. What happens if an animal comes, birds come, body snatchers, bandits to steal the clothing and the stuff, to deface the body, you know, vandals, whatever it is. Like, it's a real concern.
There's also a physicality to burying. So how does that
person, yeah.
How does that person deal with the physicality?
I guess if you literally can't do it, if one literally cannot do it, they can't do it. You're right. You're just digging earth and moving body. It's not, yeah. But it means, if a person can, you can't say, like, oh, I don't do this. There's like people that do this for a living. I don't do this. No, you do this. Now you do this. That's what a met mitzvah is. In general, it's a mitzvah maybe on others. But today, it's a mitzvah on the finder. It's a met mitzvah. That's what it is. That's literally what the definition is. And in the context, again, of our Torah portion, when Hashem says to the Kohanim, don't touch dead bodies, with the exception of relatives and a situation like this. You're a Kohen, you find this, you bury the body. You can't just run away. You can't, like, oh, I didn't see that. Keep on walking. That's not... Okay. Text number 4 extends it not only to a priest not only a dispensation, but an obligation to bury this met mitzvah, but also a Nazir. A Nazirite also has the same commandment, even though usually, let me just preface this, I think we all know this, but just to state it for the record, a Nazir, the Torah discusses, is somebody who takes an oath to abstain from alcohol, from anything that's a product of grapes, grape juice or alcohol, no haircuts, and no coming in contact with a ritual impurity. So somebody takes a vow, a pledge, and they say they won't drink wine or get a haircut or come in contact with anything impure for a period of 12 months. Yeah. 2 days in, they walk by and they see in the middle of nowhere, there's a deceased body. What do? They took a vow. They literally promised before God. What do? They break it? You break the vow and bury, or you keep on walking and find someone else? Text number 4. Steve, 72.
What is meant by the statement that a Nazir is permitted to become impure due to contact with a corpse when it is a mitzvah? If he was walking on the road and encountered a corpse and there was no one else to bury it, he should become impure through contact with it and bury it. These matters were communicated by the oral tradition.
Ah, you see, there's no biblical origin for this by the Nazir. By the Kohen, we have an extra word, by Amav. Only when he's amongst people should the Kohen not get involved. But if it's just him and the deceased, then the Kohen should get involved. When it comes to the Nazir, there's no clear biblical inference. So the sages, based on the oral tradition, say, look, if the Kohen can become defiled, needs to become defiled in a state of ritual impurity to bury this mitzvah that no one else is going to bury, so the Nazir also is in the same boat. Now then, Halacha asks a great question. What happens? Can you think of what the rabbis ask? What happens if a Nazir and a Kohen are walking down the street?
In a bar.
In a bar, but in an abandoned bar, there's no one else there, and someone had a lot too much to drink, and now they're no. I'm not making light of this, but right. So imagine if you have a Nazir and a Kohen who are traveling together. And they're the only two people that have now come across a dead body. And let's say you only need one of them to do the burial. Who should do it? Should the Kohen become defiled, or should and lose his status of pure for the next few days? Or should the Nazir break his vow and become impure? What do you think?
Kohen.
Who thinks they okay? Team again, but let me state what this is. So Who should bury the body? The Kohen? Team Kohen? Team Nazir? All right, Team Nazir is winning in our vote, and Team Nazir, I believe, is correct based on text number 5. All right, let's read text number 5, and you'll see why. You'll see the rationale cited. Alex, please read this one, 73. See that?
That's
see
the reason
that.
Why I thought.
Oh, you had the flip side of that argument?
I thought that the Kohen, because of that, because the Nazirite had made an oath to God.
So he should at least keep it for that limited amount of time. Yeah. See, you see how you could use one logical distinction and you could look at it from both sides? So it's interesting. How interesting is that? Yeah, but I'm saying I could also see the other way of looking at it. And I let the guy have his 12 months. You know, he made one pledge, give him this. But the flip side is, no, come on. He doesn't.
The Kohen has a biblical.
Essential. It's essential. Part of his DNA, right. This was by choice. That's the point. Right. He just took it upon himself for a certain amount of time. So it's kind of like a time. In other words, he's not really someone who is prohibited from becoming impure. He's only prohibited coming into contact with impurity in time. In a certain window of time, but it's not like essentially from him, it's from time. Whereas the Kohen, it's beyond time. And even, look what it says over there, my Rambam writes, even if he took an everlasting oath of Nazir, even if he said, I'll be a Nazir for my entire life till I die, it's still bound in time and not in essence. And therefore, he breaks it before the Kohen breaks it. Oh, that's what you mean. Because the Torah gave the exception, whereas only the oral law gave the exception.
I agree with that. That's really good, too.
Okay, good. Listen, we can't change Maimonides, but these are great points. See, look at this. We're having a Talmudic discussion. I love this.
How good is it? I agree with the text.
With the text.
Yes, because it's perfect logic. If you step aside from thinking the way we usually do
right.
about a Cohen's job, then, and you think about it outside the box of the Kohen not having a choice, then it's perfect logic because the Nazirite had a choice and he can do it again.
Right.
I mean,
he breaks it. Hey, he'll renew it. Let him renew it.
But God automatically forgives the Kohen, but he is not, he is more holy. His
right.
task is more holy.
Right. He's, and it's an essential
the perfect
thing.
Perfect logics
yeah.
in amongst the rabbinic wisdom. One of the most perfect.
Okay, good. Well, listen, Maimonides would be very happy to hear you say that.
Cause...
you see that? That's what. You can't make all the people. You can't. You can't please all the people all the time. Something like that, right? All right.
I knew where you were going.
Yeah.
But she says the Kohen only loses it for a short time.
Well, so everyone loses it for only for a short amount of time. In other words, when somebody gets in a state of impurity because they came in contact with a dead body, it doesn't make them impure forever. It makes them impure for about a week in the case of coming out with a body, and then they have to have the ashes of the red heifer, the paraduma, which was a very complicated procedure, and then they would become pure. So there's a way out of it. It's only for a few days, there's a way out of it. But the Nazir, on the flip side, yeah, he broke his oath, but he could renew it, he could take it again. You know, the Torah discusses if the Nazir breaks it or if he mistakenly broke it or whatever it is, he brings some sacrifices to, you know, atone for his breaking his oath, and then he has the chance to opt in again.
He still okay?
He does not need the red heifer.
Oh, everyone needs a red heifer. Yeah. Everyone needs a red heifer. Everyone needs a red heifer. No, everyone would need a red heifer. To become in a state of purity once again. Yeah, 100%. That's the only way out of it. Mikvah is not strong enough. Mikvah works for other lesser levels of impurity. The impurity that comes from coming in contact with death is the highest and most deep level of impurity, and it touches in the deepest way, and therefore requires the most elaborate procedure. Okay, and there's a lot of mystical analysis. There's the Torah portion that talks about the red heifer. Maybe we'll have a class on that. I have to see what's coming up with that in the Book of Numbers. But there's a lot to talk about on that topic, and why human death creates a greater sense of impurity or pain, perhaps. And what does the red heifer do? How do those ashes purify? Like, how does that? Is it magic? Is it ritual? Or is it significant? There's a lot to talk about it, but I'll save it for a class directly on that topic. Okay, so now here's the question. What we've seen here is that although you have two individuals that are otherwise told to stay away from burying people, a Kohen and a Nazir, nonetheless, when they come in contact with a deceased individual on the road, in the middle of nowhere, or in a city that doesn't have a Jewish burial society, they are told, you have to go ahead and you have to step up. The question is why? Why is it so important? Why does this mitzvah of burial supersede the mitzvah of staying away from impurity for the Kohen or keeping the vow of the Nazir? Why does it supersede the other statuses? So that's the answer. It's called Kavod HaMet, which means the honor of the deceased. This is a very important topic in Jewish law, a very, very important topic, I think, in Jewish life itself. And here's how I want to frame it. Judaism believes that not only is the soul, the neshama, sacred, but the body is also sacred. So that itself, I think, is revolutionary. And what's even more revolutionary is that sanctity remains in the body even after the soul leaves the body. And that's the next revolutionary statement. But let me go through them one at a time. Torah famously says that we are not allowed to harm the body. A person is not allowed to harm or pain their own body. In fact, the Code of Jewish Law says that you cannot tell a person, punch me. You cannot ask, even if you say, well, it's my choice, I'm asking for it. You cannot ask someone to harm you. The exceptions are, of course, surgery or something like that, where you are asking someone to take a knife and cut into you and cause blood to come out. The exception obviously is, because it's not in the context of paining the body, it's in the context of healing the body. So sometimes to heal, you have to open and then put back together, right? So, but that's in the context of healing. That's why the Torah says, for example, you can't pull hair out of your head, you can't cut yourself, The Torah uses certain examples of what other, I'm going to call them primitive, but some of the other nations at that time used to do when, ironically enough, or not ironically, whatever, in the context of mourning the deceased. The Torah says some would pull out their hair, or they would cut their body, and even today there's cutting, I guess, but whatever it is, the Torah says there's no pulling out hair, there's no cutting, there's no body mutilation, like not no harming, we're not allowed to harm the body. A question's asked, so what about piercing? Like people, you know, pierce ears, like why is that not? So yeah, there's different answers that are given why that's not considered permanently, you know, harming the body or whatever is defacing the body. But the overall understanding of Torah, of Judaism, is that not only is the soul holy and sacred and we have to revere it and take care of it, but the body, which some spiritualists might say, the body, break it. On the contrary, we should pain the body so because the body is no good and it's all about the soul. Torah says no. The body is the vessel, is the container for the soul, and thus the body itself is illuminated with the radiance and the holiness of the soul. And this is the body that God chose to put this soul inside. Therefore, we have to have kavod. We have to have honor. We have to honor and revere and respect and take care of the body. That's revolutionary statement number one. And the next revolutionary statement is that even after the soul leaves, the body maintains its sacred status. And that's truly revolutionary. The Torah says, and this is why, one of the reasons, not the only reason why, but one of the reasons why Judaism, right, halacha, Jewish law, is about burial. It's about burying the deceased and not incinerating and burning and destroying the body. It's because the body maintains a level of sanctity, and therefore, to do anything to harm the body, a person might say, yeah, but the body is no longer alive. It doesn't know what's happening. Judaism does not subscribe to that line of thinking. Just because the soul or consciousness is no longer in the body doesn't mean that you could do whatever you want to the body. We have to take care of the body. So we put the body in the earth and allow it to do its natural thing. But to do anything to harm the body. By the way, that's also why in general, I'm speaking in general terms, halacha is not for autopsies. Again, this is a general. There are many, you know, different conversations about autopsy, but in general, an autopsy, which involves the cutting up of the body and oftentimes the removing of organs and the discarding of those organs, right? So that's why halacha is typically not for autopsy. In some situations, you know, the city or the county or the coroner or whatever, the government, will say that they mandate it. I know people, I know rabbis, I personally have not been involved in a case like this, but I know people that have fought for the right of the deceased to not have an autopsy and have been able to secure that. You know, some have said, but what if the autopsy, you know, can lead to information that can help heal someone else, right, who might have died from the same thing, right? Halacha says that the only time you can violate the sanctity of life, which in this case, it's kind of like the sanctity of life in the deceased, right? This is why I called this class After Life. It's really life after death inside the body that is no longer alive, but it still has, in a sense, this holiness within it. But you can only violate it if the danger to life is right in front of us and immediate. If it's, let's do an autopsy to gain information so that if this happens again, we'll have that information. We might have a cure to make sure that it doesn't, you know, it's not fatal in the future. That might not be a valid halachic rationale for allowing what is considered to be perhaps the nibul hames, the desecration of the corpse, desecration of the body in order to perhaps lead to discovery, etc. But that's more about specifically autopsy. I only raise this to point out how sensitive halacha is to the body even after the soul has left. It's not only holy so long as the soul is there. It's not only sacred and has a level of sanctity while the soul is in the body and it's animating the body. Even afterwards, when the body is lifeless, it's still holy.
What about organ donation?
Oh, that's why I said there's some exceptions.
Okay.
in organ donation, some have said that, for example, the cornea, which is considered to be life-giving, because the Talmud says that someone who can't see, it's like they're deceased. It doesn't say they're deceased, but it's like they're deceased, whatever that means. But it means if you give somebody the gift of sight, it's kind of like saving a life almost. So many rabbanim, many halachic rabbis, when this became a possibility, said that one is allowed to donate, for example, one's cornea. The body is being desecrated, etc. So that one of the rationales given, and it's not accepted by everyone, but one of the rationales that are given by some rabbis is that no, the body is not being desecrated because that part of the body is living on in the recipient. So if you think, right, it depends how you look at it, right? So is it a desecration of the body, or is it, this opens up, this is a much broader topic of conversation. But I wanted to just mention it because it's a practical halakhic consideration, not only burial as opposed to cremation, but also, you know, autopsy versus staying away from if possible.
It's really important. And I'm doing a research paper right now on the Jews of Cuba, and I'm learning that it's so interesting that the first Jews, I mean, official immigrants to Cuba, not the ones that came over with, like, you know, Christopher Columbus, that were, like, trying to get the hell out of Spain, but right. the or Portugal, but the They came to Cuba to literally create. The first congregation in Cuba was a congregation designed to create a Jewish cemetery. And then, you know, a place for high holidays. But the main reason that you know, this body of people.
But isn't that amazing?
Was to create a cemetery.
I once heard a rabbi ask the following question: why is it that oftentimes you'll see anti-Semitism manifest itself in the desecration of a cemetery?
Yeah.
And so one could argue, well, it's the most vulnerable target. It's the easiest target. Like, who's going to defend the cemetery? Right? It's easy. It's low-hanging fruit, so to speak. But on the other hand, there's something else. My Oyevai Techakmeni, King David writes in Tehillim, for my enemies make me wise. And seeing where they attack first, I can think about what it means. You see, a cemetery is not just a place. Cemetery in Judaism is called Beit HaChaim, which means the house of the living. It's not called the house of the dead. It's called the house of the living. And one could say, well, it's a euphemism. It means the opposite, but we're just using this term. But it's literally called the Beit HaChaim, house of the living, because it represents legacy. It represents the history. It represents the chains, the links in the chain. It represents our people. And so it doesn't really surprise me that, well, I think we all know that whenever you go into a Jewish town, it's like, and here's the Jewish cemetery. It's always the thing, right? It's always the thing. So it's not, when you think about Judaism as this continuum that only exists, the only possibility for it to exist is literally parent to child, one generation to the other, these links in the chain, this unbroken chain. That's the only way this exists. If at any point, for one generation, collectively, this would not have been communicated, we wouldn't be here. So it's literally paying homage and respect to those forebears who carried the torch and passed it along, I think. And the idea is that in some way, their memories are still alive in us. Their legacies are still alive, very much so. They came just to build.
I mean, there were Jews there, but I'm talking about
they came together for the cemetery.
To build a cemetery.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take a look at text number 6. Because now we're talking not about, well, should a Kohen violate his sanctity? Should a Nazir break his vow? But rather, any individual, given the choice between one mitzvah and the mitzvah of burying the deceased, which one do you do? David, are we up to you? Yeah. David, text 6.
If one must choose between Torah study and tending to a mitzvah, the task of burying the mitzvah takes precedence. Similarly, if one must choose between the temple service and tending to a mitzvah, tending to the mitzvah takes precedence. Rava asks, if one must choose between reading the Megillah and tending to a mitzvah, which of them takes precedence? Does reading the Megillah take precedence due to the value of publicizing the miracle, or burying the burying the bet mitzvah takes precedence due to the value of preserving human dignity?
Right, so Rava breaks it down. He's like, well, is Megillah the exception that finally supersedes the met mitzvah because it's a public declaration of the holiday and the miracle? Okay, continue.
After he raised the dilemma, Rava then resolved it on his own and ruled that attending to a met mitzvah takes precedence. As the master said, great is human dignity as it overrides a prohibition in the Torah. Consequently, it certainly overrides the duty to read the Megillah, despite the fact that reading the Megillah publicizes the miracle.
But look how Rava, thank you, look how Rava phrases it. He says, Gadol kavod habriot, great is human dignity, referring to the mitzvah of burying the dead. He calls burying the deceased, the mitzvah, who no one else can bury, is kavod habriot. It's human dignity. It's not even corpse or deceased dignity. It's not even the dignity of the deceased. It's human dignity. Calling the deceased human. You with me on this? It's revolutionary. This is from the Talmud. This is the Jewish perspective. Yeah.
But a funeral and a wedding party, doesn't the wedding party get precedence? Both encounter.
Yeah, I'm trying. I know. I remember the question. I don't remember the answer. Ah. Now you got me thinking. King Solomon writes, greater is a funeral than a wedding. He's not talking about the halakha case. He's saying in general, it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a wedding. And he means it more of like there's more to learn at a funeral. You can learn, it's more impactful and it's more serious and it's more potentially life-changing than dancing at a wedding and having a good time, right? So that's his point. But to your question, I need to look it up. Okay, text number 7. Let's keep on going through more examples of this in halacha. And
it's a mitzvah to tend to a met mitzvah. Even a Nazarite high priest on the way to slaughter his Passover offering or to circumcise his son who encounters a met mitzvah is obligated to contract ritual impurity by tending to his burial.
How amazing is that quote? You see what the Shulchan Aruch just did? It piled all the scenarios on top of each other and said, even if you have a sandwich of reasons why you shouldn't do it, you still do it. It's not a Nazir or a high priest. It's a Nazirite high priest. The high priest took the vow of Nazirut. He's a Nazir also. He's a double agent. He's both a Nazir and a high priest. And he's on the way to slaughter his Passover offering, which you can't be impure for, or to circumcise his son. So he's got so many things going on. I can't do this. But if this guy encounters a met mitzvah and there's no one else, you got to do it. That's it. Everything else goes away and you do it. Okay. Take a look at text number 8. We talk about the reward of such action. Dan?
Praiseworthy is he who looks after the poor. On a day of calamity, God will rescue you. Rabbi Yochanan said, this refers to one who buries a met.
So when the midrash when the verse says, this is a verse from Psalms, Ashrei, praiseworthy is he who looks after the poor. What does it mean? Poor? Rabbi Yochanan says doesn't mean literally the poor, one who gives charity to the poor, but it means someone who gives a proper burial, respectful burial, to someone who was otherwise, to a deceased individual who was otherwise abandoned. So you take care of the poor in that met mitzvah case, then God is God, on the day of his calamity, God will rescue him. In other words, God repays it by taking care of that individual in recompense. Now, we have one more wrinkle in halacha, and then I'm going to get to 3 lessons that we can learn from all of this. 3 like relevant lessons. But first, one more detail that I think is fascinating. What happens if this met mitzvah is found in someone else's field? kind of, imagine like farmland, like vast amounts of farmland. So someone owns that field, right? Someone owns the farm. And this individual somehow dies in the middle of this field. So there's no community around, and someone, you know, maybe the farmer himself finds this individual in his field. Where do you bury him? Where do you bury him? Where do you bury the person? Do you take the person to the next town? Do you schlep the body? You bury them there. And it says that they acquire, the deceased acquires that piece of land. You with me on this? The deceased in Israel would acquire that area of land as theirs in the middle of someone else's property. Now, not in the middle of public property, because if it was public property, then ostensibly, if it's public, it means that there's a community around it, and then they're buried in the cemetery. We're talking about a met mitzvah, which is kind of in no man's land, but let's say someone owned the no man's land. The deceased owns a part of the land. I'm going to read you a few texts that are mind-blowing. Text 9. The sages taught in a braita. Joshua stipulated, listen to this, Yeshua, who led the Jewish people into Israel, he stipulated 10 conditions when he apportioned Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, amongst the tribe. In other words, he said, before I give you this land, you have to make these 10 promises. You have to pledge to uphold these 10 conditions. And the 10th one is, 1 through 9 we'll leave for another time, but the 10th one is, a met mitzvah acquires its place. Koneh means legally, halachically, acquires its place and is buried where it is found. You don't move the body, you bury the body right there. Aye, it's in someone else's land. It's not in someone else's land. It's in their land. It's in this person, this body's land. It's their land. Yeah, but I bought it. No. You were given into it by God through Joshua, and you promised then, and this is all in Israel, and you took the pledge, you agreed on this condition, that if somebody's found there, that it's theirs. Text number 10, I'll read this one as well. A met mitzvah acquires its place and the surrounding 4 cubits, even in a field full of saffron. Now, I don't know what saffron is.
It's expensive.
That's the point. So I guess I'll check in and make sure that that's still true today. It's still true today? It is still expensive? Look at this. Even 2,000 years ago, it's interesting. So, I mean, some things like gold, you would understand, remain valuable. But it's interesting. Saffron. What is saffron used for? Maybe that's why I've never encountered it, because it's so expensive.
It's coffee, doesn't it? It's like
it's wait, what do you use it? Food? It's in food?
You make like paella.
Yes, threads. 4 or 5 threads can cost $15-$20.
Seriously?
High quality.
Really?
Yes, I have saffron.
It looks like an empty bottle.
It's a very Jewish business right there. It's like, what is it? Ah, it's expensive. It's the good stuff.
It's like,
oh, okay. But listen to this. The Jerusalem Talmud says, 2,000 years ago, it says, look, you own a field of saffron. It's very expensive. Nebuchadnezzar, somebody passed away in the middle of your field. So you would say, okay, listen, let's do this. Let's relocate right outside of my field. No, they're buried right there. It's my field. It's your field. It's not your field. It's his field now. This is how this is how far Jewish law goes, halacha goes, to preserve kavod habriyot and kavod hamet, the honor of people, beings, and the honor of the deceased. It's that you don't move the body. It's that you bury in the place. Again, if there's a cemetery and a burial society, yeah, of course you move from the house or from the hospital. Okay, but we're talking about a very specific example of this met mitzvah. Don't move the deceased. Bury right there. And in Israel, they actually acquire the land. Okay, now. Oh, here we go. You know what? Let me read text 11 as well. Because that's the final text about the legalities of it, before we get into the 3 final messages, the takeaways. Text 11 is about nowadays outside of Israel. Whoever finds a met mitzvah must bury it wherever it was found. He need not bring it to a cemetery. That's the general law. But Marshall writes that the reason we don't follow this practice nowadays is that the land we live in does not belong to us. And we don't have the authority to bury a met mitzvah wherever it may be found. In other words, yeah, we live in the United States of America. You can't just bury people wherever you find them. It's not like the government will allow that. It's not a thing. So in Israel, okay, it ran by halacha, Jewish law. But this is, you know, outside of Israel, there's a different set of laws. even if, and the Maharshal continues, or the Shach, who's one of the commentators in the Code of Jewish Law, says, I'm not sure if this is still a quote. Yeah, this is still a quote from the Maharshal. So he says, even if we were to bury it wherever it was found, let's say a person didn't ask any questions and just went ahead, didn't ask the government, didn't ask the county, and just, you know, still, hey, like quietly just buried the deceased, there's still a risk that non-Jews would dig up the grave to remove the corpse garments, or that the grave will be otherwise disrespected. Therefore, we bring the corpse to a cemetery. In other words, there's concerns outside of the legalities of whether or not one can, but is it a good idea? And if the ultimate objective is the honor of the body, is it honorable to bury the person in a situation where it's not in a Jewish cemetery, it's random in the location, and somebody might say, what is this? This looks like a grave. Let me dig it up, or otherwise, you know, desecrate it. Then it's going against, it's working against the whole rationale of this mitzvah to begin with. The whole rationale is to do what's best for the body. In certain situations, what's best is to move it to a cemetery. And that's the way halacha is outside of Israel, you know, in the diaspora. That's the way it stands today.
To have a place
that they could protect, yeah. And again, Judaism puts. I think this is not one of my three takeaways, but I mentioned it, and when I mentioned it, I said it a few times specifically, intentionally. But the extent to which Judaism honors life, even after death, right? The life of the soul, even after death, permeates the body. And makes the body honorable even after it left. That's an amazing lesson. So three takeaways. Number one, on a very practical level, there are situations in which we might encounter literally this mitzvah. Situations that we might become aware of where somebody passes away. Maybe they were visiting somewhere, they're out of town, and there's no relatives, and whatever. This is a tremendous mitzvah in its most literal sense. If we ever encounter a situation where this mitzvah is needed, and it's not just if, you know, encountering a deceased individual, you know, in an abandoned place, but anything, again, in a situation where somebody becomes aware of someone who passes away, maybe there's no money for the funeral, or maybe there's no relatives around, whatever it is. One should see to it that they participate in this mitzvah, because it's a tremendous mitzvah. As well, I would say a corollary to this lesson is, if someone is aware of someone who has thought about cremation as an option, it's kedai, it's worthwhile to discuss the values in Judaism of the burial. And again, I mentioned it in passing before, yeah, I mentioned kind of quickly before, but it's a very, very, very critical mitzvah. It's critical on a practical level, on a spiritual level, on a Kabbalistic level, on a soul level, on a grieving level, on a connection level. There are many different levels that it's... I just want to share one quick vignette. It actually happened with the Sharfsteins. I heard this from Rabbi Sharfstein a month or two ago. He has a student there, a graduate student, brilliant student. I actually know him as well. He's... I don't know, high level, just a very bright young fellow. He's in graduate school at Georgia Tech. And he has a grandfather, I believe, who lives in Montreal. And his grandfather wasn't doing well. And he became aware from his father, I think it was his father's father, maybe his mother's father, whatever. He became aware through his parent that his grandfather had in his will that he wished to be cremated. And he heard this. And he, you know, he's connected now with Chabad on campus. And he became, you know, he was a little upset by it. So he went to the rabbi and he just kind of shared this, and then kind of said, you know, I don't know what to do. There's nothing I could do. This is his will. Like, what are you going to do? This is what he wants. So Rabbi Sharfstein encouraged him to have a conversation with his grandfather. He flew to Montreal from Atlanta, and he sat down and he told his grandfather, you know, I love you, and I care about you, and we all love you, and we all care about you, and this is very important to me. Maybe he said us, you know, that you have a burial in the traditional Jewish fashion. You know what his grandfather said? He said, oh, I didn't know it was so important. No problem. I'll change it. And he was so, you have to understand, he put himself, this student, he put himself through the ringer beforehand. He was scared. He was anxious. How do I speak to him? What do I say? It's like hard, uncomfortable. He's like all of the emotions, and he just, you know, speaks honestly and openly to his grandfather. He's like, oh yeah, it's important. No problem. Yeah, I just thought, like, no one cares. It's the easier, you know, the easier choice. But yeah, I'll change it. We don't know sometimes how things are going to go unless we try. So on the most basic level, the lesson from tonight is how important burial is in halacha, in Jewish law, and treating the body with respect is. That's one. Number two, this goes back to what I said at the beginning of the class in the context of comfort zones, staying inside the box, inside our comfort zone. So we like to stay inside our comfort zones because it's comfortable. But growth happens often out of our comfort zone. This mitzvah, you know, Karen, you mentioned before, well, what if you can't bury a body? I would say, what if you can, but you don't want to? Like, who, what? There are people that sign up to be involved in funeral homes and preparing bodies and all that stuff. There are people that sign up for that. Most others don't want to get involved. And yet, push comes to shove and there's a need, Torah tells us, you have to jump in. But I'm not comfortable doing it. I get eked out. It's not. I can't take blood. I can't take, like, it's not, I don't like it. It's a mitzvah. Sometimes a mitzvah is not so comfortable. That's where the growth happens. The Talmud says, and it's one of the texts here, I'm just paraphrasing. The Talmud says that one who studies, who repeats, who reviews their studies 100 times hasn't served God. But one who reviews their study 101 times, they've served God. And the Talmud says, what does that mean? He says, I'll give you an example. If you hire a donkey driver to take you 10 miles, they'll charge you 1 coin. 11 miles, 2 coins. 2 coins, double for 1 extra mile. What a ripoff. Let me pay 110, right? $1.10, not $2. It's $1 for 10 and 2 for 11. What kind of deal is that? 10 is in the range of the animal. 11 is out of the box. And if it's out of the box, it's more difficult. It's not just a little bit more difficult, it's fundamentally more difficult. It's double as difficult. They used to study, everyone used to review their studies back in the day. They didn't have the internet. They used to review their studies 100 times. That was a joke. But they also literally didn't have the internet. So they reviewed their studies 100 times. That's how they knew the whole Torah, backwards and forwards. To review it 101 times, just one more time, that's where you move the needle. That's where you break out of your comfort zone. And so the message here is, should we only stick to the mitzvot? Again, even if we never encounter this particular mitzvah, but in general, should we only stick to those mitzvot or those ideas that speak to us, that are in our comfort zone? Maybe one message from this mitzvah is sometimes it's good for us also to break out of our comfort zones and to do something that's a little bit uncomfortable, you know, to do something that's a little bit difficult. That engenders growth. And the final message is a teaching of the Rebbe. The Rebbe says the following, text 16, and it speaks for itself. I'll read it and it'll speak for itself. Page 86. The Rebbe says, a met mitzvah can exist in a spiritual state. Here we go. There are those who, for whatever reason, can be likened to a spiritual met mitzvah. In other words, I'll just explain, not to any fault of their own, but they are spiritually not as alive, perhaps, as they could be. Regarding this, the Rebbe says, a Jew must know, even if you are as lofty as a high priest, nevertheless, you are obligated to come down from your spiritual heights to help another Jew who at present is a spiritual met mitzvah. For if an actual high priest is obligated to tend to an actual met mitzvah who is no longer physically alive, how much more so must one go out of his way to spiritually revive a living met mitzvah? A person could say, I'm a great Torah scholar. I should teach children Aleph Bet. Right? I'm a great Torah scholar. I could spend all my day studying Talmud and writing deep insights on Talmud. I should go out of my community and open up a small school for children in the middle of the country to teach Jewish children that would otherwise not have any education, Jewish education. Not literally, God forbid, but a met mitzvah, spiritual met mitzvah. I should leave my lofty space in Torah to teach Aleph Bet, the Hebrew letters, to a child? Your Rebbe says, yeah. That's why you should know Chabad is revolutionary on many levels, including, and my grandfather was one of those guys in the 40s, yeshiva student, and he went to Worcester, Massachusetts, and New Haven, Connecticut, and other places to start schools. And yet yeshiva students who knew Talmud and were very, you know, smart guys, and they went and they opened up schools for little kids. I am leaving my lofty perch in the world of Torah. Yeah, you are. Why? Because this is the mitzvah. This is a pressing need at the moment. Even a real Kohen Gadol would really become impure physically to tend to this mitzvah. The Rebbe says, same thing for us. That the high priest, let's continue and we'll conclude, that the high priest must even put aside his loftiest service in the temple, the ketoret, the incense on Yom Kippur in the Holy of Holies, for the sake of a met mitzvah. In other words, if that would happen, he would not go to the Holy of Holies. He would, if on the way to the temple Yom Kippur morning, theoretically, he encountered this, he would have to become impure and then not do the service, right? So if that's the case, for the sake of the met mitzvah, that proves that tending to the met mitzvah is more important. And if so, it will bring the high priest to even greater spiritual heights than his Yom Kippur service would. If God puts you in a position to help someone else out, and it seems like a downgrade, oh, there's no downgrades in God's world. If you're doing something, if you're doing what's right and what's needed, it will lift you up. The Rebbe said many times that if you're ever concerned that if you're helping somebody, you're going to take away from your Torah study and you're not going to be able to accomplish, the Rebbe said God will figure out a way, and in the less amount of time that you have to do your own studies, it will be concentrated. It will be, you'll accomplish more in the 1 hour than you would have in the 10 hours that you would have had otherwise. God will figure it out. This, in short, is the mission taught by my father-in-law, the previous Rebbe. What the Rebbe always called his father-in-law, the Rebbe. Each and every one of us must toil in spreading the Torah and Judaism in every place, to leave the four cubits of holiness and to go out into the street to help those who are like a spiritual met mitzvah to become living Jews who observe the Torah and mitzvot. So with this, we'll conclude three lessons, a very literal lesson to take care of those that are in need of this mitzvah, this particular mitzvah of burial, personal message for us to break out of our comfort zones, to do what is right or what is called upon, even if it's not so comfortable. And the third lesson, to extend ourselves, to go out of ourselves, to be there for others, even when it seems like it's going to be detrimental to ourselves. Because if it's the right thing, it's never detrimental. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.